And welcome to the Senate Revenue Committee meeting for April 3rd, 2001. Today we have three bills before the committee. SJR 16, Senate Bill 188, and Senate Bill 467. Let's take a moment and rearrange our schedule. Let's hear Senate Bill 188 first. And that is a bill that we'll ask the committee staff to orient the committee to. And to do that, we have Elizabeth Martin Mahar do our orientation this morning.
One for each, please.
Morning, ma'am.
Chairman Ferrielli and committee members, with Senate Bill 188, what it is doing is allowing the Economic and Community Development Department to establish areas of economic distress and inadequate lending practices as community development investment areas. There will be criteria will be established to identify the economic distress. It will establish a tax credit for the financial institutions that make loans for owner-occupied housing, commercial development, or agricultural development located in those community development investment areas. The Economic and Community Development Department will adopt rules to set the criteria by which the loan beneficiary population may qualify for that income tax credit on or after January 1st of 2002. Cities and counties may apply to the Economic and Community Development Department to have this area designated as a community development investment area for the purposes of the tax credit. Now, the main part of the tax credit is in Section 8. And it outlines there the requirements for that income tax credit, which is a certain percent of interest that is earned on qualified loans. There are three missing components, one being the percent of the loan beneficiary population who are owners or employees of business entities that are receiving the loan, also the percent of the financial institution's interest earnings, which are then going to annually limit that amount of that tax credit. And then the percent of the financial institution's total outstanding loans for the tax credit, which would then be the threshold that a financial institution would need to meet in order to qualify for the tax credit. So the amount of tax credit in a given year shall not exceed the tax liability of the taxpayer, but the credit is allowed to be carried forward 4 years. And it applies to loans made by financial institutions in tax years beginning January 1st, 2002. So at this point, we don't have a revenue impact, because it will depend on those criteria that you establish.
Thank you. And is there any questions from the committee? Senator Minnis?
Just clarification. Staff mentioned three missing parts. They're not parts missing from the bill. They're blank lines in the
they're
bill.
Blank lines.
I started looking for right, curious, trying to figure out what was missing. So.
Senator Minnis, not unusual for the individual legislators to have some parts left over after a bill's been constructed.
It happens.
Thank you for the clarification. Any other questions for Ms. Martin-Mahar on the bill explanation? We'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 188, and I see before us Senator Avell Gordling. I'd like to call her forward to help us find the missing parts of the bill. Good morning, ma'am.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Avell Gordley, representing Senate District 10 in Portland. Missing parts?
Actually, Senator Gordley, we are in reference only to those percentage designations in Section 8 that appear on page 3 under Sub B in paragraph 3 and 4, which talks about the percentage of owners or employees of the business entity, percentage of the financial institution's interest earnings, and percentage of the financial institution's total outstanding loan portfolio. We need to fill in those blanks at some point in the process.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I agree, and I'll talk about that a bit in my testimony. Again, good morning. I bring Senate Bill 188 before this committee to advance the discussion of supports and incentives to invest in the economic and community development of Oregon's economically distressed rural and urban communities. let me give you some background to Senate Bill 188. Over the past 4 years, my good friend and colleague and your committee chair, Senator Farioli, and I have worked together in our communities with the Economic and Community Development Department to establish criteria for economically distressed areas in urban and rural Oregon, and to use the distressed area criteria to move to more effectively work with local communities. The new direction vision of the Economic and Community Development Department passed in the 1999 legislative session emphasized priorities to solve local problems identified by regions now through the regional investment boards. And the boards are up and running and putting grants into communities around the state. My experience on the board of the Albina Community Bank has also raised the issue of needed support and capital assistance for locally owned and operated institutions committed to community redevelopment efforts. And we will get to you a letter from Robert McCain, President and Chief Executive Officer of Albina Community Bank, who points out that as Oregon's only community development bank, Albina has focused specifically on lending to North Northeast Portland, one of the largest distressed communities. We have demonstrated that this type of lending can be done successfully, but also that it carries a higher degree of difficulty and risk than the traditional markets. Senate Bill 188 would assist us in offsetting some of the costs inherent in meeting the credit needs of these markets, and I believe would create incentives for more traditional institutions to focus on them as well. Just by way of example, Albina Community Bank is one of the partners in lending to the Renaissance Market up in Northeast Portland. This is a grocery store which was developed by a church. This is a market, a grocery store that sells no alcohol, sells no cigarettes, employs underemployed folks from the community, including former gang youth. The store is making a profit. And again, this was considered to be a high-risk project for investment, but Albina Community Bank was one of the partners willing to take that risk. Mr. Chair, the other thing I would point out is that the Federal Community Development Financial Institutions Program offers a model for capital support of community redevelopment activities, and California offers a companion state model of a tax credit to incentivize support for community redevelopment programs. The Oregon Bankers Association may be able to provide more detail with regard to that aspect, and I don't know if they're here to testify on the bill this morning, but they would be a great resource for us. Given this background, I would like to make 2 points clear. First, Senate Bill 188 is intended to use the distressed area criteria already developed with and through the Economic and Community Development Department. And Mr. Chair and committee members, you'll recall that we passed legislation in 1997 that clarified what that distressed criteria would be. And then second, the local needs of economically distressed communities and the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department seed money and regional reinvestment funds necessitate private financing support in order to be successful and sustainable. The challenge remains how to encourage and incentivize the higher degree of risk for community redevelopment financing. Again, I would like to defer to other experts who may be in the room, including OECDD, for fine-tuning the bill and coming up with a supportive approach to enlist financial institution partners. The regional boards and the distress area criteria are in place. We need the financial institutions to step forward as Albina Community Bank has. And, Mr. Chair, I would just conclude with recollection of when I traveled on one of the trips over to your district. I can remember hearing from community folks, business people, and one of our meetings talking about the difficulty of getting bank loans to finance small business startups. So I just recall that as a way of saying that this may be a tool to offer to some of our communities that are looking for opportunities to develop small business startups and, again, to participate in the become more economically viable communities. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will close and take any questions.
Questions from the committee. Senator Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Gordley, do you have some suggestions for the missing numbers?
My thoughts on that, Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, hopefully that this that the chair of your committee would appoint a work group that hopefully would include yourself, Senator Byer. I've been thinking
well,
about this. I've been thinking about this, and I, you know, apologize for springing that on you this morning, but I frankly would like to draw on some of your guidance and expertise in this particular arena of economic and community development. Again, I think this is a tool worth exploring to see how it might work in our communities. I think asking for some additional guidance from the Oregon Bankers Association and perhaps other partners, and most certainly the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department could help us flesh out this proposal.
Senator, I'm looking at page 3, lines 14 through 16, number 4, and I'm curious when you, was it your thought that that section there seems to imply that it would have to be a significant activity of any lending institution to qualify, and it would appear to me that that would probably on the surface disqualify any financial institution that was statewide or was rather large in general, just in the nature of the beast doing that. Is your intent to focus just on small community-based financial institutions?
That is in line with my, Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, that is in line with my thinking, but again, I think this is very open to discussion and the exploration of a work group to talk about how this might actually work in some of our local communities around the state.
As you looked at this, and I guess I want to call upon your experiences, I think you said you're a member of the board of the Albina Community Bank. Is credit a significant issue in that area, the extension of credit in the neighborhoods?
Mr. Chair and Senator Byer, yes, we do find that some of our small business folks have some credit challenges, but we are a bank that is willing to sit down with our community partners and look for ways to resolve some issues that may be barriers.
Mm-hmm.
We're willing to take some risks, but yeah, the credit issue is a problem, can be a problem.
Primarily a residential or a commercial lending issue?
Both.
On the commercial side, has the state credit enhancement program helped that situation or the small business SBA programs?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I believe so, yes.
But not enough?
I would say not. Again, that's why we have this proposal before you. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions on the committee? Committee, I think the, if I might just add an observation to Senator Burley's testimony, the thing that we found in common was that access to credit is an issue in Northeast Portland and the inner city areas. Actually, you can see elements of access to credit problems in distressed communities throughout the Willamette Valley, but also a particular feature in rural Oregon. The consolidation of banking has created a situation where access to local lenders, local loan officers, local decision-making is largely absent from the multi-state institutions. We've seen a rapid rise in community banking, which has filled some of that need. But every institution in the state of Oregon is subject to the operation of the Community and Reinvestment Act, which requires them to make a certain number of dollars of investment or by lending into distressed communities that they serve. I'm not aware that any institution would claim to be out of compliance with the Community Investment or Reinvestment Act. I'm also sure that there isn't much of a mechanism to make sure that they are in compliance. Perhaps legislators have been remiss in making sure that the federal laws in that regard are being followed. What is certainly true is that it's anecdotally very easy to determine from people's personal experience that moving into a small rural community means moving away from easy access to credit for small businesses and for all kinds of lending purposes. In the case of Grant and Baker County, with the flight of the large banks, the community-based banks have moved into that market and grown rapidly. But some of the other institutions like credit unions have filled a niche that they're not traditionally servicing in those communities, and that's commercial lending for small businesses. Mostly credit unions are family-oriented businesses that finance automobiles and home mortgages and second mortgages and home improvement loans and education loans, et cetera. Only a few of them really specialize in business lending. Those few that do tend to be in remote rural areas where there is no other access to credit. So the question here is, now do we still have the practice of redlining in Oregon, that is making credit available in certain areas and avoiding other areas where arguably the risk of loans or lending is higher, or the value of security is lower, or the distance and difficulty of loan servicing is greater? I can tell you that it's a feature that exists. You know, it's difficult to document. It's one of those issues that I think is a fact of real life in rural Oregon and in distressed communities. This is an effort, rather than placing blame with anyone, to try to create an incentive for a profit-making institution to take another look at their loan portfolio with regard to their lending in rural and distressed communities, and maybe be a little more aggressive about placing those loans because there's an incentive to place those loans. So it's, I think it's an incentive-based approach, a little bit different than asking for a regulatory audit to see if banks and lending institutions are following the Community Reinvestment Act letter. So I applaud the approach. I think it's a much more constructive approach. And that's why I'm happy to join the Senator in sponsorship of this bill. Like other tax credit bills, it will need to be taken into consideration alongside other tax incentives that we've created, at least in theory. And we'll have to look at whether or not they're affordable when we look at the revenue stream in May. But I think it's an excellent opportunity to look at a good incentive program
to build lending capacity and to make folks reassess their own portfolios in these rural and distressed communities. Senator, I thank you for bringing your testimony. We have some other folks here that have offered to testify on the bill. I'd like to call them forward.
Thank you
very
much.
Does the committee have any other questions for the good senator from Northeast Portland?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, ma'am. I'd like to call forth Mitch Conley and Mr. Michael Mason, both of the Warm Springs, Confederated Tribe of the Warm Springs. Good morning.
Good morning. By way of background, I'm a native born Argonian, raised, educated, been an independent businessman since I was 6 years old.
Sir, would you speak your name for the public record, please?
Mitch Conley.
Thank you, sir.
I run a small business development center on behalf of the Warm Springs Tribe. In 1990, I was the first economic development director for the Grand Ronde Tribe and basically wrote their economic development plan. This bill is very important. Lending on the Indian reservation is almost non-existent. Last year, the SBA guaranteed 6 Indian loans in Oregon, which is nothing. At Warm Springs, the problem became so difficult that the tribe funded its own credit issue. Last year, I had an incident of a tribal member who had been in business for 12 years, had a net worth of just under $1.5 million, had no business debt, was unable to get a loan from a bank outside the reservation. I guarantee if that had been a white individual, that loan would have gone through without a problem. In Warm Springs, the nearest banking facility is 13 miles away. There's one ATM at the casino. That's the end of it. Now, most loans for small business on the reservation are small loans. Banks generally are not profitable. Most of them start up. Again, the record in industry is dismal. They don't want to make the loan. And any reason not to do it, they will jump on. Any access or any incentive for banks or financial institutions of any kind to come into a distressed area like the reservation, like Northeast Portland, like the rural parts of the state, is a valuable tool for a small business. Because the biggest problem that they're all faced with is financing their enterprise. Now, this bill, you were talking earlier about lending it to community development banks. Personally, I think that would be a mistake, because any entity that had the capability of making loans that would go into a distressed area to do so is a valuable tool. And personally, I think that it should cover anybody that's capable of lending.
The that's good testimony, sir. I guess the only issue that jumps out at me at this point is that only profit-making institutions would be covered by this legislation. This is tax credit against their profit. So I guess we'd look at credit unions as nonprofit organizations as not being covered by this legislation at present, in its present form. It would look at the commercial lending institutions and banks more than others. I want to make that clarification.
All right, I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. It would be, perhaps it should be considered for nonprofit institutions as well. Where I sit, any entity that would make loans on the reservation is a valuable asset to our tribe and tribal members.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really a question of access to credit more than almost any other thing. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Conley. I'm intrigued by this. Your experience in the business you're related to, did it attempt to get a loan from any of the public lenders. The state of Oregon, through the Economic Development Fund, offers a small portfolio of loan programs. I know the Economic Development District over there operates a public loan pool. Do those just not work?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, no, we did not go to that process. Had Warm Springs not had its own credit program, we would have. But the access to Warm Springs credit took that problem away, and we took the fastest and easiest solution.
Cheaper?
Considerably
right
cheaper. Yeah, 5.5% interest.
Yeah, that was a good decision.
Yes.
I guess I'd like to ask if we could take this a step further. If generally commercial lending is difficult, and that's an understatement, what about other access to other forms of credit, credit cards, credit line lending? Are they pretty much in the same category?
Yes, sir, they are.
So the issue is if you don't haven't established a lending presence in a community, or if you haven't established a lending history for a business or an individual, it's difficult to have other access to other forms of credit as well.
Extremely difficult. Several of my clients in their mid-40s have never had credit. I mean, we pull a credit report, or a bank pull a credit report, and it's just blank. And they don't know how to deal with it, quite frankly, because it's not the individual has bad credit, he just doesn't have any credit.
And in terms of consumer purchases, credit cards, automobile loans, and commercial credit, no credit is bad credit.
No credit is bad credit, absolutely.
Falls into the, what's wrong with you? Why haven't you been using credit?
Of course, this is a quarter of the population aspires to the condition you're describing. They have no credit debt at all.
But it is a serious problem. In any program that would give some benefit or some reason for lending institutions to make an occasional risk, in my opinion, is very valuable for the small business community, because no economy can be successful or be good without a private sector economy, thriving private sector economy. And that largely doesn't exist.
Senator Barnes?
Thank you. I want to call upon your experience again. I'm trying to fill in the good senator's blanks.
Actually, I perceive that the vice chair is trying to avoid the good senator's working group.
not necessarily, but based on your business experience, how much of a credit do you think it would take to induce a bank to make a loan in a distressed area, starting from the point that apparently they're not very interested at all?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I actually couldn't give you an educated guess, and that's what I don't
mean.
Anything that would take the loan out of the bad risk, any kind of financial inducement that would make it profitable. Once again, most of these are small loans, so going in the front side, the bank is not going to make very much profit, if any profit, on them at all. Now, to me, it would have to be a fairly significant tax break, mm-hmm. if you would, to make that incentive enough for them to come in. Now, in total, as far as the revenue lost to the state of Oregon for this, I quite frankly don't think it's going to be significant. In specific, talking from the Indian side, last year the SBA, the Small Business Administration, made 6 Indian loans. That's nothing. We probably needed 5 times that. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with the group Onaban, which is I'm the individual that created Onaban, and I still remain on the board of directors. We put through approximately 40 to 50 tribal member businesses through our education classes every year. I would say less than 10% of those are able to find financing of any kind to actually go into business, which is, again, the significant issue, access to credit.
For the record, could you identify Onaban, please?
Onaban is a...
Just speak their names, sir.
Oregon Native American Business and Entrepreneurial Network that is created by the Indian tribes of the state of Oregon.
Yes, sir, you're describing a problem that first-time entrepreneurs that apply is whether they're in a distressed area or not. Just the nature of the lending business is people, lenders tend not to be real excited about lending to business startups. I agree with you that it's much more problematic in remote distressed areas.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, that's absolutely true. The problem is most startups finance their operation from family and friends. The issue with the distressed area is family and friends are poor. They do not have the money to get it going. No lack of good business ideas or the capability to operate a business. Just a lack of money.
The old saw, lenders only want to lend money to people who don't need it.
Yeah, and it's getting more difficult.
Any questions?
I appreciate that.
Mr. Mason, do you have some testimony you'd like to add to the record?
Mr. Chairman, if I was looking at a point of clarification here. Michael Mason, I don't want to mess up your microphone placement, but I'll just pivot it a little bit. Well, Mr. Chairman, we appreciate the opportunity to testify. I was just checking with Mr. Conley about what I believe to be the fact that people at Warm Springs are better off than other Indians in the state because they do have a lending program. And there, to my knowledge, is not a lending program like that for the other reservations and for the other tribes. Some of that has to do with many of the tribes being fairly recently restored, not having tribal status. There are good historical reasons for it, but the result is that people have even less availability for financing and for credit than Warm Springs members on the Warm Springs Reservation. So, if anything, the situation is worse everywhere else. And I will make the usual caveat that I am not testifying for any other tribe, but just to point out that the problem, if anything, is far worse outside of Warm Springs.
Question.
My client, just an idea. Has anybody, have the tribes explored at all of perhaps going collectively with a small amount of money that would establish a small business investment corporation and getting matching funds for seed or capital investments from the SBA? You could leverage your money fairly well.
Chairman and Senator Beyer, let Mr. Conley answer that question.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, absolutely. Affiliated Tribes Northwest Indians, which is a consortium of all the Northwest tribes, is currently in the process of putting a, call it a small business loan program together. Onaban looked at it for a number of years, in fact got into the lending business itself in order to access the SBA loan program. The problem is the staff and the money that it takes to run it. So Onaban backed away and is working with the Affiliated Tribes Economic Development Corporation now to put that in place. And obviously the reason is for access to capital, which does not exist for the majority of tribal members.
This pops into my mind. I was doing some business with the, actually didn't end up doing business with him, but with the Grand Ronds, their investment officer, and there's a substantial amount of their portfolio going through that. And I was just thinking there's enough collectively together there with a small risk that you might be able to put together an investment corporation and leverage, much like the other venture corporations, private and profit, are doing in the Portland area and in the e-commerce mecca markets. If there's a program out there that could make some sense.
Yes, sir. And that is what the affiliated tribes are doing.
Other questions? Mr. Mason, do you have anything further?
Just that this is considered a very, very important bill by the
Tribal Council of Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs. We urge you to support it, and to reiterate that we do see a very minimal fiscal impact. It'll take some time to get this up and running, and there are not a lot of folks out there, even with this, that are going to get lending, we think. But any additional credit help is needed. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Before the panel excuses itself, this is a different approach than we've got in loan guarantee programs. Every financial institution, including credit unions, have access to Ginnie Mae, Fannie Mae, HUD 235 programs, and small business assistance loans for the Small Business Administration. But those are primarily a guarantee, and what they do is they guarantee a portion of a loan repayment that exists above the value of the security that's lent on. So the lender has this residual security value to collateralize the loan, and above that, there's the guarantee from the federal institution. And so the incentive of the lender is to reduce the risk on the loan to as near zero as it possibly can get. That approach has not worked in areas where the security is farm equipment, livestock, a business located in a rural area, or where security is located not in an area that's convenient, or maybe the security isn't portable. Because the residual value is the risk. The collateral value is the risk. So it has worked in many areas where there's a clear business history, or there's a farming or agricultural operation that collateralizes as well. But it can be impossible for an entrepreneurial person to try to convince the lender to make the base loan, so there's never a question about the guarantee through the federal agency, because they won't make the base loan. This is a different approach because it provides a profit incentive to increase the yield net to the lender. In other words, there's more money in it to the lender. It's a direct incentive. So I think chairman is inclined just to poll the members here in the committee to see if there's the patience and the energy to hear the bill again after we've convened a working group to ask them to fill in the blanks and maybe provide additional direction on the form. Senator Breyer.
Mr. Chair, I have an interest, and I would appreciate before we did that hearing from Mr. Houston, who runs the state's finance programs and will serve in his take on that.
Has Mr. Houston any inclination now? Does Mr. Houston wish he'd been absent this morning from this evening?
He's our high-paid specialist in this, Seth.
Mr. Chair, I was going to try to get a loan from those two retired state police officers back there. They tend to have a lot of money in their purse, too. So I was thinking maybe we could hit them up before we're done today, too.
Senator Corcoran, they pay out a lot less. You don't want to borrow anything from those guys.
You will repay those loans.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And you better be interested.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Mark Houston. I manage business finance for the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. Just a couple of more technical comments, the department would be happy to work with the committee or any of the working group related to this bill. The first comment, and again, these are more from a technical perspective, but the bill does envision that a community development investment area would be established. One of the things that the committee may want to look into is we currently have a distressed area definition that has been identified in the department through previous legislation that is more of a standard definition that cuts across a number of different economic development programs, and I have a definition for that for the committee.
Senator Gordley attached that to her.
Okay, very good. And I can would make that available. But the committee may want to consider using that as a as an alternate definition. There are some differences related to the policy issues that I think substantially are in line with what the community development investment area concept is. The second comment is the department would adopt rules setting forth the criteria for a qualified loan beneficiary population. I think the department is fine with establishing what that population would be, and the legislation gives, I think, broad authority to the department to do that. However, the committee, in this forum or maybe in future forums, may want to discuss from a policy perspective and for the record kind of what those eligible businesses might be, whether or not they would be businesses losses or have flat sales or what that definition might be. In Section 8 of the bill, which is on page 2, and it's line 42, it defines a qualified loan beneficiary population and means a targeted segment of residents. And I guess there was a question in our mind about residents, and again, this would be for the committee to consider if residents would be individuals or if that would be businesses. I think the bill does contemplate it would be businesses, but it would just be for clarification on that issue. Another issue, another policy issue the committee may want to consider is that that basically all types of loans would qualify. For example, in whether or not the committee would want to exclude some type of loans, for example, refinancing of existing loans and or sale of existing homes, those kind of things might be policy issues for the committee to consider. And then finally, there's sort of an unknown total volume of loans that might be made. I mean, and the tax credit is unknown. The committee may want to consider putting a total cap on the overall tax credit, given that that's an unknown at this point in time. But those are more sort of technical comments on the bill, and we'd be happy to work with the committee or a subgroup of the committee to address those issues and have further discussion. And
I'd have to have the second member of the working group identified. Senator Corcoran, question?
Mr. Chair, I guess the question that I'd have, I know there's a statistic that 65% of OECD's monies now go into rural and distressed infrastructure issues. I guess the question that's sort of begged by the bill is why isn't there a financing system available now through Oregon Economic Development for the tribes or for inner city distressed areas or for the Oak Ridges of the world or East Oregon places? And if there are mechanisms, how would this bill complement those?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Corcoran, I think Senator Ferrioli did describe, and I'll just a little bit of background, but we do have several business loan guarantee products where we work with banks around the state to provide guarantees for business loans that are made in all areas of the state and in distressed areas through Senate Bill 402 from the last session. The legislature did give us additional capability to make loan guarantee available, for example, doubling our match in distressed areas of the state. So we have more flexibility, more capability for making loan guarantees in distressed areas of the state, and we do have those products, and we're working with 40-some banks around the state for providing loan guarantees currently. We also have some direct loan products that the legislature has approved in previous legislatures where we can provide subordinated loans and loans to startup businesses. This program does appear to be a different tool, if you will, that I think Senator Ferrioli did describe accurately, where a guarantee provides that level of support for a bank to make a loan that's what I would call an almost bankable loan, and it gives them that ability to go that extra mile to make that loan. This would be a different tool, if you will, to provide the tax credit for the bank to make to look at those loans in the higher risk arena and provide that incentive. It is a different perspective, I would say, from a bank's perspective, but it it would give a different tool in the toolbox, if you will.
Mr. Chair, just one follow-up. I'm not real familiar with banking and loans, but would you have a situation where a bank could, in essence, get the benefit of both the current program and the incentive so that if they took on a high-risk deal, they could have the support mechanisms that are already there to guarantee the repayment or guarantee the interest on it, I guess, and get an incentive as well?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Corcoran, I think, at least the way the bill is written, at this point in time, we would have the flexibility to do that. I think that the way, and again, I think the working group can look at this, but it would, that may be something in the rules where the department may want to either exclude that capability or possibly, again, this would be at the policy direction of the committee, to offer both, if that's the direction that this committee would prefer.
And again, there is one more follow-up, Mr. Chair. How many groups or entities have taken advantage of the policies that we've put in place regarding these guarantees in the past few biennia?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Corcoran, again, and these are numbers, I guess, off the top of my head, but I would say that for the small business lending programs, probably 700 to 800 companies in the last two bienniums have been have had guarantees put in place for them. We probably have 30 or so active financial institutions that are providing those loans to businesses that are guaranteed through our various programs.
So they're using them?
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Question, Senator Minnis.
Do you have any analysis of loan defaults and the risk factors?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, I do, and I'd be happy to get the committee that information. Generally, we see it varies from program to program. For some programs, like our industrial development bonds, we have no losses to the state. On our higher risk startup loan programs, our losses are in the neighborhood of 3% annually. And for our guarantee products and subordinated loan programs, it's more in the neighborhood of 1% annually. And just a general comment related to that, for both the guarantee products and the direct loan programs, we charge fees and charge interest on our loans, so we offset our loan losses and our administrative costs with the earnings on the fund. So actually, we do are in the black, if you will, on those programs. For microloan programs, it's that we do see some net losses in the program. But
Mr. Chairman, wouldn't you expect to see losses a little higher than this?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, we work from our standpoint, obviously, to make good loans and try to that they are loans that are repaid by the company. I think our losses are probably 3 to 4 times higher than what a commercial bank would see. Even though those may sound small, commercial lenders, do not see on their overall portfolios the substantial loan losses. So, we are taking higher risks with the investment money. So I think in perspective, they are higher risk loans, obviously.
When you're going to grant this kind of a loan guarantee program, is this generally granted to someone who's not met a test of creditworthiness in an application for a bank loan in a commercial bank?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, and generally the programs that are on the guarantee side, there's a fee that's charged to the borrower on the loan. So if the company can get a loan conventionally, and it's in their financial interest to just obtain a conventional loan, so that these are higher risk transactions and borrowers that would not otherwise generally have access to capital.
Chairman, one follow-up question. Do you keep data relevant to who these loans are going to, whether they're to specific minority groups or not?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, we do keep those records in particular for the last biennium. We've been more, we've worked on that effort more diligently. There is some reticence of some financial institutions to ask that question, if you will, about minority populations in particular. But we do try to get as much information in that area as we can.
Can you give us an idea what the percentages are?
I'd be happy to.
Further? Senator Byron?
Just a general remark. Do you think this will make a difference?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Byer, I've not seen this program, and I was interested in the California model. I'd be interested in studying that in more detail to see their experience. A difficult question, I guess, to answer.
Like you paid the big bucks.
From our perspective, I think, you know, any tool that we could have that will help us get additional lending into distressed areas would be helpful. You know, I think that you know, those kind of incentives are useful for economic development purposes, for the business development purposes, and I think that in particular, you know, encouraging, you know, some financial institutions that are like Albina Bank that have made, you know, those kind of commitments to distressed areas and providing those encouragements are helpful.
Just one follow-up. Mark, I was interested in Senator Minnis's comments. I wonder if without a lot of work you could maybe have something, a report or something that you could provide the committee that would kind of give a description of the loan programs that we are operating through the state or participating in with others and sort of the volume, number of loans, caches. And I'm really interested in the default rates, and if you can give us a sort of an industry standard in the private side so we can get a relative sense of that, that'd be helpful. And I'm assuming that if we form a work group that you're just chomping at the bit to participate.
Chomping would be a good description. Senator Minnis had a question?
Well, it's kind of a statement, maybe might evolve into a question, but, you know, I've been in this process for a long time. And I remember 10 or more years ago having discussions about tax increment financing. And, you know, if you read the statute relevance to tax increment financing, it talks about distressed areas and so on and so forth. And I've always found it fascinating that tax increment financing districts always seem to stop right at the edge of the blighted area. You know, it's like where the Portland Convention Center was at. That was a tax increment financing project, and it stopped right about where, you know, the obvious distress was. The same thing was true with the Clackamas Promenade development, Clackamas Town Center. That was a tax increment financing project, and it was literally a cow pasture. So, you know, the problem with us here in government, I point our fingers at us, is we do lip service to this nonsense. And that, not nonsense in terms of the target audience, but basically we create programs that makes us feel comfortable politically, but we rarely, if ever, gauge our success in trying to really deal with targeted minority populations who are disadvantaged in terms of employment opportunities or education and training relevant to, you know, good credit, business startups, and so on and so forth. I mean, there are, you know, incubator projects that have gone on. I don't know if we're engaged in any incubator projects for business startups or not, but, you know, and that's why I'm a little concerned about this failure rate. It seems to me that if we're really going to target some kind of loan guarantee program or some other mechanism that we think is going to get money to small business startups for certain targeted populations, we should have and should go into it with eyes wide open, expecting that there'd be a certain level of losses, because that's inherent in venture capital. But what we don't ever have in front of us are some real success stories that say we started with a risky loan with a particular entrepreneur or business person, and here's what they've created. We don't have those success stories I've seen. And I think that's because we always side on the side of being very cautious,
you know, of appeasing everyone who has an interest in this and just doing, you know, the marginal stuff, the stuff that banks may not do because they're a little bit shaky. And, you know, I really think that we're all show and no go when it comes to this stuff. I'm sorry, but it makes me sick to my stomach that we do this nonsense. We just don't do it. We don't compel some of the larger corporations in the states and the folks that have the resources and the money to invest in the areas that we know can benefit largely from that kind of investment. We just continue to do the lip service.
I'd like to bring forward Judge Mike MacArthur, who has done a little bit of research in this very issue, who, as happenstance has it, also found himself in this proximity of this hearing and has been sucked into the podium to add his perspective. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Farioli, for the record, I'm Judge Mike MacArthur of Sherman County, sometimes known as Mr. Rural and Distressed. The problem of financing of any type of economic development or business in our county, in our region, has long been a sore spot with me. I've looked at the records of the deposits on record for the banks that serve our area, and then looked again at the amount of money that comes back into the community and found that there's wide discrepancy. Judge Pryor in Gillum County has done a more detailed study of that, and we can get you that information if you'd like it. But it's essentially, the capital flows out from our area. Our economic development plan showed that there was about $36 million a year generated in our county, and only 10 stayed. 10 million stayed to recirculate. It's a disinvestment downward cycle. The problem is that the investments that can be made with those dollars elsewhere are much more profitable. So if there isn't a growing market, there's no reason to invest there. You can make more money investing somewhere else. So there needs to be additional incentives to invest in rural and distressed areas. That's the fundamental problem. Our growth rate is below 3% in the county. So assessed values aren't increasing. The markets, therefore, follow these, are reflective of the assessed values. And so you don't see people wanting to put capital into that type of situation unless there's another good reason to do that. And anything you could do to incent capital in both staying in the community, because most people who have any money are invested in other instruments outside the county. I went so far as to try, and I'm currently trying to do this, create an investment club of like-minded citizens who feel like there needs to be some investment capital in the community and say, let's all put in $100 a month. And, you know, my goal was to get up to $1 million and invest in small businesses that needed a little help getting started that would be beneficial to the community. Well, I ran right into the Securities and Exchange Commission. I can't find a lawyer that'll touch it in terms of setting it up because they fear that
they'll just have to find another pyramid scheme. The other thing that occurred to me is that if every citizen from cradle to grave in Sherman County invested $100 per month, somewhere around the year 2035, you'll have your $1 million.
I was hoping some might be a little more generous, but can get there quickly.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you. Judge, I'm curious, the banking services over there, are there any community banks?
There's one bank in our county, and it's a part of a chain. And they provide
one bank
in the whole county.
You can bank there, or you can bank somewhere else.
How about credit unions?
We are served by banks in Wasco County, and there's one regional bank that most of the farmers work with because of, they have been supportive of the farm industry, and it's when it's been very difficult to support the farm industry, so people have been loyal to that bank. But even that bank, even with its regional nature, doesn't find much opportunity to reinvest in our communities.
Judge MacArthur, I heard you say just now that any mechanism that would increase the profitability of lending in rural and distressed communities would make the difference between the decision to lend in a county like Sherman County or the decision to lend elsewhere where it's more profitable.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Any questions?
Thank you.
Colleagues, the chair is inclined to ask for the committee's further consideration of this bill after we have a working group meet to fill in those blanks. Maybe also to just give us some sense of the lending that's going on out there with the current guarantee programs, and also to find out, just in the broadest sense, whether or not we are seeing compliance with the Community Reinvestment Act.
I don't think you can do the last part.
Well, we might not be able to, but I still think it's a question worth asking, and I know that the federal law requires banks to make a report. So maybe just a compilation. And what I would ask is that we have two senators who have personal and direct experience in this issue. Senator Byers has already been identified, who's done economic development for the city, for the county, and for a variety of private clients. Ken Messerly sits on a bank board in a small community-based bank, and I would like to ask Senator Messerly if he would add to his incredibly busy schedule, and it would be an invitation only. Mr. Conley's here from Warm Springs. I'd like to ask if he would be willing to stay with this issue long enough to help fill in those blanks. Tim Martinez represents the banking industry in the state of Oregon, and I think it would be remiss of us not to request him or a designee to help review the bill and help us find a merit in the bill or create merit in the bill and then fill in the blanks. And then I think we ought to ask one community-based banking CEO, and I have in mind Bruce Konosky from the Community Bank or someone from Pioneer Bank, which is active in the Eastern Oregon communities, or somebody from Western Oregon Community Bank. There's a number of folks out there, but I think we need a CEO from a small bank. Senator Nunes?
Mr. Houston.
Oh, I have Mr. Houston down for a ex officio technical advice and staffing, because I think what we want to do is, since OEDD has a directed function in this bill as it moves forward, I don't think we want him to craft the bill, but I think we want him to be technically available to advise on the bill. That is why I also have not asked Senator Gordley or I to serve on the working group, since we have sponsored the bill. We want to hear what other people think about it. Senator Nash, you had a hand there?
Mr. Chairman, I think some contact with the Portland Development Commission might be a good idea, and maybe ask some questions how they can invest as much money as they do in developing ideas like capping freeways and moving freeways and promenades and so on and so forth, and can't somehow figure out how to get some of those dollars and investment strategies into the inner northeast area or the southeast area.
I think we should ask them if they would be interested in helping make some recommendations. The other thing is I think that we're really trying to work at a different end of the scale. I think the Portland Development Commission works, in the high rent district of the stratospheric atmosphere, and I think we're trying to get money down to the community level. Senator Gordley, did you have additional testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to say I appreciate very much Senator Menas' recommendation of including PDC. I support that recommendation and would encourage you to be in contact with Robin Roberts specifically.
We'll ask Robin Roberts of the Portland Development Commission also to join us in ex officio.
And, Mr. Chair, I believe that Robert McCain, president of Albina Community Bank, would also be willing to provide assistance. Thank you.
We'll ask Mr. McCain if he will be willing to serve as a community bank representative as well. Colleagues, so what I'm asking you today just is, are we willing to hear the bill again and work the bill after we get the committee report? And
sure.
If that's the general consensus, then I think I'll close the public hearing on this bill, ask that the staff work it into our rescheduling. I think we've had an excellent hearing on the bill, made a good public record. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 188 with the idea that we will bring it back when the committee's finished its work. I will work with the staff of the committee to make the appropriate invitation letters to those that we've named as potentially members of that working group. Colleagues, we have two other bills before us, Senate Bill 467 and SJR 16. I'll open a public hearing on both Senate Bill 467 and SJR 16 and ask if there's anyone here present that wishes to offer testimony on these bills. Yes? Come forward, please. Yes, ma'am.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Genoa Ingram, representing Multifamily Housing Council of Oregon. I apologize. I was down in another hearing room this morning and I've not been following your procedures or your deliberations. And I understand you're just getting to this bill. Multifamily Housing Council looked at both bills briefly and have not gone into a great deal of analysis on the bills. However, we initially objected at first blush to legislation that would treat un-owner-occupied properties different from owner-occupied properties. It seems to put different standards on non-owner-occupied properties than it would, for example, if a owner-occupied property was in the same state of disrepair. And we're just confused and concerned, more questions than anything, about why properties that were rental properties would be treated in a different manner than those that were perhaps in a worse state of repair but were occupied by the owner. And came here today with more questions, really, than testimony. We heard testimony yesterday on the rent control issues regarding why rents are so high. And one of the things that we tried to bring out in our testimony was the fact that there are a lot of requirements put on rental property owners, and it tends to drive up the cost of rent, which is then passed on to the renters. And this seems to be one more way that rental properties would be affected in that manner, where additional requirements would be put on the owner to show why your property isn't up, why your property isn't being taxed at the same rate that other property is being taxed. And we just believe that that's one more swipe at affordable housing, and that's something that we're trying to promote.
Questions? I have a couple for you. You, of many witnesses that appear before the committee, have what I consider to be absolutely impeccable credentials in terms of your knowledge of real estate values, real estate transactions, housing issues of all kinds. And I think the well-recognized evolutionary pattern of neighborhoods is build up, and there's a stable period of value, and then there's an inevitable tilt over and decline. And that's over a 50-year economic life of most neighborhoods. In that decline period, what's most frequently seen? You know, describe what a declining neighborhood looks like.
Mr. Chairman, first, thank you for the compliment. I felt like I was being battened up for the kill.
Just an open book.
In my experience, a declining neighborhood initially will start out with usually the first sign is the yard's not being kept up, the shrubs are overgrown, the lawn isn't mowed. The second phase would be physical appearance of the structure. For example, the paint would start to chip. Windows aren't being replaced. The next thing you know, there's litter. And then usually it is my experience that the bulk of those tend to be non-owner-occupied properties. There are things going on around the structure that, activities are not being policed, sometimes illegal activities. What we have found, particularly in the worst-case scenarios, where a drug house and those types of activities may be going on, then tends to have a ripple effect throughout the entire neighborhood, and it does impact property taxes throughout the neighborhood. It does impact property values. However, let me follow up and say that it is not just non-owner-occupied properties where those occurrences are happening. It could be owner-occupied properties. And I think what we object to, and again, this is at first blush, having just briefly perused the measures, is treating a rental property differently than you would treat a property where the owner is occupying the property. Perhaps maybe the same exact circumstances exist, but the one that's a rental property is being singled out. And we feel that that's damaging affordable housing.
Now, Ms. Ingram, far from being fattened up for the kill, I think the point is you brought an important potential constitutional problem, which is this equitable treatment of classes of owners. And I think that's something that the author might have to look carefully to solve that problem. I'd like to follow up on the question of decline. If you look at the ultimate outcome of that decline, isn't that redevelopment? At some point in time, doesn't the neighborhood values fall to a level so low that it ends up becoming redevelopment property?
Mr. Chairman, in most cases it will, and sometimes it will decline to the point where the property is near valueless, and someone will come in. There are individuals who look for properties in neighborhoods like that who will purchase them at a very low price and, you know, rehab those properties. Yes.
And we've heard that sort of resurgence of valuation called gentrification, where people move into a neighborhood, buy up the properties, redevelop them for their historic or appearance value, possibly even taking advantage of tax credits available for redevelopment of historic properties or restoration of properties. And then you'll see a recurve where the neighborhood will get hot, and we've seen that in parts of Portland on the 22nd, 23rd area, where it really was a dilapidated, relatively ignored area, and all of a sudden it's become the hottest neighborhood in Portland, for instance. We've seen some redevelopments of downtown areas do the same kinds of things. But that usually is a long-term process, 50 years, up to even 100 years. I guess the question I have is, do you see any value to an approach that spikes that curve earlier in the life expectancy of a neighborhood, instead of allowing it to go all the way through that 50 to 75 year of increased stasis and then decline, to try to find a way to spike the redevelopment of those neighborhoods?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my personal feeling is yes, and I can see where you're trying to get, and I think that's laudable. It's too bad that the properties do have to bottom out before they become so affordable. It's expensive to refurbish a drug house. You know, it's expensive to refurbish some of these homes that have been in disrepair for so long that you have to rip out the boards and replace the spongy floors and, you know, all of that. And you know, we see where you're trying to get. I guess our objection, again, is that it's creating a class system of owner-occupied properties.
Well, I appreciate that. The feedback, I think that's valuable, and maybe we'll take another look at the differential treatment of classes of property.
Mr. Chairman, multifamily would like to work with you on the issue, maybe to come up with some, it is a new idea that we haven't seen before the legislature before, unlike so many of the bills that come forward. We've seen them in previous sessions, and this particular issue has not been discussed to my knowledge or to my recollection, and I've been around 21 years, started when I was 12. We would like to work with you in discussing the issue further. There's so much to explore here, and the end result, we believe, is beneficial to the neighborhood and to the not just that block, but the entire neighborhood and to the city and to other taxpayers. And we would be interested in visiting with you on how to resolve that issue.
Well, similarly, the League of Oregon Cities has indicated that they're interested, at least in this. Let's call Michelle Durster. And Ms. Ingram, thank you for the offer. We'll take you up on that offer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Question, Senator Barr?
Question of the sponsor.
Yes.
What are you trying to do?
You know, we use public policy and we use taxation. We use taxation to raise revenue for local services. But the interesting thing for me is that we seem to be incenting by providing, or through an unintended consequence, rundown housing, rundown properties generally have a lower tax burden than similarly situated properties in proximity that are not run down or dilapidated or with deferred maintenance. The whole neighborhood ends up suffering valuation erosion. The local taxing district loses revenue, and the cost of services to those dilapidated properties and depreciated properties goes up. Higher maintenance costs, higher police, fire protection, public service, public agency costs. And it's not necessarily a desirable condition to provide a tax incentive for that kind of deferred maintenance. And I'm looking for a mechanism to give local...
So your sense is that they're pulling the property values down and reducing the taxes available?
Well, I don't think they're doing it intentionally. I think the unintended consequences is the value declines. The cost declines with it. And I was thinking if we had a mechanism for those communities to provide a little bit larger stick, which is if you have a deferred property that has a higher social cost, you pay more in taxes. That would incent people to hear the deferred maintenance and perhaps redevelop a neighborhood. Let's hear from the League of Oregon Cities.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Michelle Deister with the League of Oregon Cities. And yes, Senator Farioli, we are very supportive of the concepts that you're talking about in terms of maintaining neighborhoods and in providing an incentive to preserve residential property. As you mentioned, doing so will help stabilize surrounding property values and city revenues at the same time as it increases the livability of neighborhoods. To maximize the potential of this proposal, we would suggest some additional flexibility in how the additional revenue resulting from the inverse taxing district is allocated. Currently, as you
know... Rural schools, maybe? Oh, sorry.
That wasn't exactly what I was thinking, but currently the bill requires this revenue to be used only for infrastructure-related projects within the established inverse taxing districts. So local governments... really don't have the ability to allocate the funds to non-infrastructure related priorities within the neighborhood, such as maybe an additional police officer for crime prevention, et cetera. Some of the other consequences that you might have been talking about associated with neighborhoods in decline.
So you would say to improve the bill, knock the sideboards off the limitation of additional revenue expenditures?
I think allowing a little bit of additional flexibility is would certainly be helpful from a city standpoint. As you know, there are limited revenues and a lot of competing priorities. And, you know, I see no problem with targeting it to the neighborhood in which the inverse taxing district is established because that's where the revenue is coming from. So that's a good nexus that I think needs to be maintained.
Questions, Senator Byers?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If the goal is to turn the neighborhoods around, one of the premises of that usually is that the higher the owner occupancy is in a residential area, the more stable and less crime and all that. Why wouldn't we want to, if you're going to do this, turn it around and make it available to cities for investments, loans, what have you, to owners of people who reinvest in the neighborhood?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I think there are a lot of possibilities in terms of how this revenue is allocated, and I guess I would defer to the author of the bill in terms of what kinds of possibilities he is envisioning in terms of trying to maybe see the particular results that you're looking for. But that's certainly an option that we would,
My sense is reinvesting in infrastructure will do little to. Mm-hmm. Turn the neighborhood around.
Mm-hmm.
Better
reinvest. Yeah, you're not going to get reinvesting in more police officers and that. While it may address the problem, it's not going to do anything to turn it around.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think the author of this particular concept is gratified that there's at least some interest in trying to make the thing a little better. Maybe see if there is a mechanism for using. Property taxes is an incentive for redevelopment in neighborhoods. It seems logical to me, and it's not intended to be discriminatory against non-owner-occupied housing. It's intended to try to solve a valuation erosion and incent a better connection between the valuation and the way a neighborhood functions over its economic life. Senator Beyer.
Mr. Chairman, like your philosophy, I'm a little skeptical that the tax system is working that way, mainly because of the way we restructured Measure 50. My guess, and I'd really like to hear from the people who do property taxes, is that the system isn't paying any attention to deterioration at all, that those babies are climbing 3% a year. because I know we eliminated the six-year cycle.
Yeah, and I think maybe this is a solution in search of a problem now, after maybe 50. But I appreciate the committee's willingness to hear the bills, and let's go ahead and close the public hearing, cut loose approximately on the time schedule that we've laid out, and the author of the bill will work with at least the two interested parties to see if we can't come up with a concept that might have a chance of survival in the process.
That's two interested parties in the entire state.
Yeah, so far, so good.
When we get rid of the exemptions, then you won't even have them.
It is an interesting concept.
Thank you, and we're closed in the public hearing on Senate Bill 467 and SAR 16, and we're in adjournment today.